people we've found, for the most part, expect a reliable system.
Coastal communities look to solve service issues in the event of an earthquake. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Memorial Day, Monday, May 29th. Good evening. I'm Sean Dugan. Also tonight, hiring for teacher turnover replacement is costing the Anchorage School District millions.
We didn't calculate the benefits that are associated with those employee wages, and that would add significantly to the cost, too.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The Early Honors Program at Alaska Pacific University delivers an experiential, individualized, and transformational education to high school seniors across Alaska. Find out more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
U.S. and Alaska flags were flying at half-staff today until noon in recognition of Memorial Day. The holiday recognizes people who have died in military service. In a White House proclamation, President Donald Trump designated 11 a.m. local time to unite in prayer for permanent peace, and he asked all Alaskans to observe a national moment of remembrance at 3 o'clock local time. The proclamation notes this year is the 100th anniversary of the United States entering World War I. It's a war in which more than 4.7 million Americans served and more than 100,000 died. Governor Bill Walker urged Alaskans not to forget the men and women who've made the ultimate sacrifice protecting the nation. An Alaska volcano that has been active for nearly 6 months has erupted again. The Alaska Volcano Observatory says Bogusław Volcano in the Aleutian Islands erupted at 2:16 p.m. Sunday. It sent an ash cloud of at least 35,000 feet in height. The eruption lasted 55 minutes. Ash can harm and even stop jet engines. Ash from Southwest Alaska volcanoes is a threat to airliners operating between North America and Asia when a cloud rises above 20,000 feet. After the eruption, the aviation color code was raised to red, the highest level, but it has since been downgraded to orange or watch status. The agency says a person on nearby Unalaska Island reports seeing a large white-gray mushroom cloud form over Bogusław, with ash falling out to the west. U.S. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke says the name for America's tallest mountain should remain Denali. Zinke spoke at the Fairbanks International Airport late Saturday on his way to a Memorial Day ceremony in Denali State Park. The peak was once called Mount McKinley. It was named after President William McKinley. President Barack Obama's administration renamed the mountain Denali, which translates to the Great One. It was a symbolic gesture to Alaska Natives in 2015. During the campaign last year, then-candidate Donald Trump vowed to change it back to Mount McKinley. He has not renewed the sentiment since becoming president. In a joint statement, Alaska's congressional delegation says it looks forward to showing Zinke Alaska's beauty and potential, as well as the impact the Interior Department decisions have on Alaska lives. Alaska schools hire about 1,000 new teachers each year to offset annual turnover of staff. It's a process that doesn't come cheap. And as Alaska Public Media's Josh Edge reports, it's costing school district millions.
$20 million. That's the approximate cost of replacing teachers lost to attrition each year throughout the state, according to a recent study by the Institute for Social and Economic Research. And as school districts look for ways to make up for diminishing state funding, they're also seeking ways to better invest the money they do have. Todd Hess is the Chief Human Resources Officer at the Anchorage School District.
When the district has money, their first priority is to channel that into the education of our students and improve quality of their experiences, the quality of their curriculum, all of those things.
But each year, ASD has to hire between 275 and 350 teachers to replace those lost to turnover. After accounting for administrative, recruitment, and hiring costs, plus orientation and training, each of those positions costs the district a little under $20,500 on average to fill. That totals out to about $5.6 million just in Anchorage. And the ICER Studies head author, Dana DeFeo, says those cost estimates are conservative.
We estimated the time and the wages associated with doing all of these tasks and all of the people who are involved. We didn't calculate the benefits that are associated with those employee wages and that would add significantly to the cost, too.
When a teacher leaves the district, the cost can be measured in more than dollars. DeFeo says the more important impact is on the students.
When a teacher turns over, it has a significant effect on the school climate, the continuity of instruction as teachers plan from one year to the next, how they're going to deliver content. The school community relationships are really contingent upon the stability of the staff in the school, and most importantly, the impact on student learning.
There's general agreement that the solution for lessening districts' budgetary burden for turnover is not necessarily reducing the more than $20,000 per teacher cost, but instead emphasizing retention. And when it comes to increasing retention rates, one common thread throughout the conversation is community. Here's ASD's Todd Hess.
The Anchorage School District is employing another of different efforts to bring people on and integrate them not only into the school district, but also integrate them into the community and trying to make connections with different aspects of the community as well as different teachers that live in the community so that they feel connected to the community.
The importance of community connections is something Jack Walsh can agree with. He's the superintendent of the Craig City School District, but he's also a Chicago transplant who got his start in Alaska at Sand Point, where he says the community did a great job making him feel welcome.
It wasn't always perfect, you know. There were times where they wished I was doing things different, and there were times where I wished I had other opportunities there. But all in all, it was a great place to be and to get my start, and then it saw similar sort of things happen in Kodiak and Bristol Bay and now in Craig that just kept encouraging me to stay.
Now, 30 years later, Walsh is still in Alaska. Around 70% of the teachers hired in Alaska each year come from out of state, many of them, Walsh says, with brand new teaching degrees.
Remember, if you're coming out of a college or university and you're taking your first teaching job, one of the things about that is, you know, university campuses have lots of different things available, often at low prices and stuff, including housing and things like that. You're going to move out here and you're going to find that there's some challenges.
Those types of challenges often make it difficult to retain newly hired teachers, especially in rural districts where turnover rates can be around 30%. Larger, more urban districts average a turnover rate of about 10%. Research also suggests teachers hired in-state are more likely to stick around. But with Alaska's colleges and universities only graduating about 200 new teachers each year, that leaves the majority to be hired from the lower 48. And with state funding being set after many Alaska school districts have already finalized their budgets, teachers who want to stay in the state are often left wondering if they will have a job next year. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Two plane crashes took the lives of four people in Alaska on Saturday. Alaska state troopers say David Kunot, a 29-year-old Juno pilot and an adult male passenger from California, both died when their plane crashed southwest of Haines Saturday morning. Troopers said another passenger, 31-year-old Chan Valentine from Juno, survived the crash and was transported to Bartlett Regional Hospital by helicopter. 81-year-old Sam Bryce of Fairbanks and 64-year-old Howard Buzz Otis of North Pole died after their single-engine plane crashed while landing 30 miles south of Fairbanks on Saturday. Fairbanks Police Chief Eric Jukes was among the names listed of those involved in a fatal officer-involved shooting in the interior city last week. Alaska State Troopers say Chief Jukes, Fairbanks Police Sergeant Ron Dupress, and officers Tyler Larimer and Dennis Benn fired on and killed 23-year-old Sean Buck, who had rammed officers with his truck. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a film of cultural importance to the Amonok community is being digitally restored after 40 years.
Because they presented a truer picture of what life was like in their villages.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway,
and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
How long would you stick around your coastal community if you hadn't had a shower in 30 days and your neighbor hasn't either? Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports on the choices leaders are making on both sides of the Pacific.
Let's make this real by going first to Seattle's sister city in Japan. You may recall a big earthquake struck Kobe in 1995.
It's also hard to fathom why, here in one of the most developed parts of the world, firemen are slowed down because the water supply has been cut off.
The magnitude 7.3 quake knocked out water, electricity, collapsed a main highway and railway, and killed more than 6,000 people. Kobe is now in the process of replacing nearly 3,000 miles of cast iron water distribution lines with flexible pipe to make its system earthquake resistant. Hitoshi Araike is an assistant manager at the Kobe City Waterworks Bureau.
I guess that the damage we have received in the earthquake kind of determined that we will replace the pipes.
Araike and an interpreter led foreign journalists deep underground to see a new large transmission main that can double as emergency water storage. It cost a fortune. He described automatic shutoff valves installed at reservoirs to keep water from draining away after a quake, and he showed the flexible pipes and new-style connectors with reinforced sleeves that resist breakage. They're being deployed at both the waterworks and a rebuilt sewage treatment plant. I asked Araike how long water service might be out in his city after the next great earthquake.
Once the new technology is in place, I expect zero disruption.
Zero disruption?
How does this compare to the Pacific Northwest?
We'd like to get back up and operating within 3 to 4 days. That's our goal from a level of service standpoint.
That's Jim Miller, engineering superintendent for Everett Public Works. I spoke with Miller as contractors were reinforcing walls and ceilings to earthquake-proof the operations building at Everett's drinking water treatment plant. It serves 600,000 people across Snohomish County. Miller says his utility assessed its earthquake vulnerability and has prioritized a list of improvements. Next, the Public Works Department wants to install flexible joints at some pipeline water crossings. Everett's full list of seismic upgrades could take 20 years to complete. The cost would be folded into multiple rate increases. Miller says rate hikes above the pace of inflation inevitably draw pushback.
If we did nothing, that's more, you know, business as usual. And so you could keep rates lower. But people we've found, for the most part, expect a reliable system. And once they understand what it's for, they seem, in fact, our wholesale customers have actually encouraged us to make our system more resilient.
Everett is one of the big three drinking water suppliers in the Central Puget Sound Water Supply Forum alongside Seattle and Tacoma. The forum recently estimated outage times for a big offshore earthquake and close by shallow ones. Their analysis found it currently could take up to 60 days to restore service to most customers. In Oregon, a state resilience plan set a goal for water supply systems to be mostly operational within 2 weeks after a Cascadia megaquake. We're nowhere close to that, says the chief engineer at the Portland Water Bureau. The current projections for long outages of vital services mean you need to prepare to survive on your own. State and federal emergency managers used to recommend to stockpile food and water for 3 days. Now Oregon and Washington suggest people in earthquake country prepare 2 weeks' worth of supplies. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
The Ta'aku Kwan of Douglas Island raised a totem pole in front of an elementary school on Saturday to mark the site of a disturbed graveyard. KTOO's Quinton Chandler reports the pole symbolizes the pain of historical trauma and a need to heal.
If it's too much for certain individuals, if you can, say help, okay?
At least a couple dozen volunteers listened to directions before they bend knees and backs to grab wooden beams sitting underneath the 26-foot solid wood Raven totem pole laying on its back.
For those that are on the sides, we're going to need you guys to switch out if somebody says help. Okay? We don't want anybody to get hurt while we move this.
Like pallbearers, the volunteers stand and slowly carry the pole toward a crane waiting to lift and place it on a metal base that sits in front of Gastineau Elementary School. 61 years ago, the school was built on top of Indian Cemetery, a graveyard for the Tlingit Taku Kwan. Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, the Douglas Indian Association, and the Juneau School District organized the totem pole raising and a ceremony to reflect on social injustices inflicted on the Taku Kwan. Andrea Cariente Laiti was keynote speaker at the ceremony. She sits on the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation's board, and she's also the tribal administrator for the Douglas Indian Association. She said construction workers accidentally unearthed three burial sites on the school property in 2012. Five people were in the graves.
One was a young woman, and it was determined by the archaeologists that she died in childbirth. So that leads us to assume that the remains were not just the young mom, but that of her infant.
She said another man was buried with what might have been his prized gun collection. Cariente Laiti likened building Gastineau Elementary over the cemetery to someone building an office building over Evergreen Cemetery, a 9-acre memorial in Juneau that the city estimates over 8,000 Juneau residents have been buried in. Cariente Laiti and other speakers also recalled the impacts of the city of Douglas's intentional burning of Douglas Indian Village in 1962, decisions to build roads over graveyards, property loss, the loss of fishing rights, and the suppression of the Tlingit language. Cariente Laiti said those actions had powerful effects that were passed down to today's generations.
We don't necessarily feel it or see it, taste it, but somehow through our parents we know it's there, so we see their sadness.
It is hoped that raising this Raven totem pole will pay respect to the grievances of the past, restore the Taku Kwan's ancestral connection to the land, and signal their desire to heal and move forward, culture intact. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're a K-12 teacher, consider the University of Alaska Southeast Juneau campus for Summer in the Rainforest continuing education courses. Two sessions offered, Basic and Beyond Arts Institute, July 24th through 29th, and Indigenous Arts Institute, July 30th through August 4th. Stipends, scholarships, and on-campus housing are available. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu/summerrain. This message is sponsored by UAS.
One of the most significant films about Yupik culture has been digitally restored. The Drums of Winter is an award-winning documentary shot in Amonok 40 years ago. After 3 years of restoration work, it's now being shown around the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur spoke with some of the people who made the film.
4 decades after it was made, The Drums of Winter is considered a significant contribution to American culture and has a home in the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. But at the time it was made, the film was an experiment.
We set out to make films that we called community collaborative films.
In 1977, Len Kamerling, along with Sarah Elder, wanted to make films in a new way, involving the community in shaping the film. Elder, who had lived in Amonok as a teacher, wanted to work with Kamerling to make a documentary with no narrator, no English voiceovers over the Yupik, no one interpreting the film for the audience. It was considered a radical idea at the time. They showed up with no script, no idea the story, just cameras and open eyes.
And one door after another opened, and we were brought into that world of the Kuzigik and the dance.
The Kuzigik, the men's house in traditional Yupik villages. What they captured in the film is considered authentic and relevant, even 40 years later. retired University of Alaska Fairbanks Kuskokwim University campus professor Cecilia Mart said she would regularly show the film in her cross-cultural and anthropology classes.
Because they presented a truer picture of what life was like in their villages than, you know, books. Because a lot of us are like visual learners, and they learned a lot from those films.
The digital restoration of The Drums of Winter has added new dimensions to the film. Co-producer and director Len Kamerling says digitization has deepened the colors and brought light where there were shadows.
Waukee Charles, who is our main language advisor and coordinator, he's from Mnemonic, and when we showed the new one in a scene in the Kuzigik, what used to be dark shadow now was illuminated, and he could see his father there, and his father who had passed away. So that was a really wonderful thing.
When they showed the film in the Yukon village last week, most people in the audience could see now deceased relatives. One of the young men in the film is now a dance instructor in Mnemonic. Everyone watching was connected to what they were seeing.
People mostly talked about the continuity, the sense of continuity that the film gives them of, you know, of being able to look back on their relatives, on their culture at that time, and what could be learned from it, and the importance of having that sense of continuity. And I think the young dancers were very taken with that as well.
Professor Martz, who grew up in Chivac, says the film also shows how dance in the region has evolved.
For instance, like at the Chamay Festival, you see a whole bunch of people up on the stage. At that time, when I was growing up, only certain groups of people were designated a song and a dance. So you might have five or six people that could do that particular dance. Maybe if you were lucky, maybe you danced twice.
What people are singing and dancing about has also changed since the film was made. Now, Mart says, you're as likely to watch a dance about basketball or Anchorage traffic as a song from the past. But what has not changed is that people are still dancing. In the film, some worried that dancing was going to disappear with the younger generation. But as that generation grew up, a Yupik dance renaissance began sweeping the YK Delta and continues to this day. The Drums of Winter captures a moment of that long tradition for a future generation that's carried it on. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The video game Minecraft is being used in Petersburg's 7th grade computer science class to teach students basic programming skills. KFSK's Angela Denning reports.
To the adult eye, it might look like these 7th graders are just playing a computer game. They're at their desks, hunched over laptops, eyes darting around a virtual world. But this Minecraft is different than what kids play at home. The access is secure. Only the students and teacher can get in. And there are assignments.
Everybody here is working on the same world, just in different places.
That's Latham Johnson.
We have different projects we have to do. Like right now, we're going to start working on a mine, and we're going to have a mine cart leading to that mine so we can transport stuff back to our house.
That's a house that they build, and a mine that they also build. Minecraft is part of a semester-long exploratory course, which lets the school design the program.
We have more freedom within it.
John Clute Painter is the technology director. He teaches Mac Tech in the high school and this class. Here, students learn a little programming and engineering.
First project is just basic skills, and they're showing how to use redstone and creating inverters and clocks, and so pistons and the mechanics of those things.
What does redstone mean?
Redstone, let's ask a student.
Redstone is a property similar to electricity as humans use it.
That's Kara Newman. Her team is in the back of the room. Newman says they are working to reestablish their settlement to get more privacy from other students.
We used to live on the mainland, and we've moved to an island on the ocean that's full of more resources because where everyone is living is very drained out.
Resources like stone or iron.
so naturally we're going to have to go elsewhere to find what we need.
Teammate Leah Kittums has been spending her time getting resources for the group.
Mostly I go into like caves, and some of them, they go down into like ravines, and that's where you will find the most resources.
Across the room, Sean Spiegelmeyer types on his laptop. His team is working on something different. They have spent a ton of resources on a quarry.
Instead of us spending the time mining for the resources, it does it for us.
How'd you figure that out? Did you make something to mine for you, or was that like something that you found?
Make it. It's really expensive to make. Like, it costs a lot of diamonds and iron and a lot of resources. But when you make it, it's really worth it, because it mines for you, and that's something that takes a lot of your time in Minecraft.
The curriculum for the course and instructional videos were created by Petersburg High School students. Junior Van Abbott helped put the syllabus together.
It really helps with creativity and problem solving, because if something's not working, there's nothing to tell them why it's not working. They have to go and figure that out themselves, find the problem, and then modify it so it does work.
Abbott also helps maintain the server for the class. I ask him, as a junior in high school these days, how often do you use a computer?
We use it for everything, basically. Even math class, which is just paper and pencil, we use it because our textbooks are online.
For a few minutes, sure.
Back in the 7th grade classroom, Clute Painter sits at the front of the room watching the students work. He's monitoring all the computer screens, which are displayed on an overhead projector. He says there's a lack of computer science programs throughout the country and skilled graduates.
And so there's a real strong need, and everything now has programming running it. So it's another literacy to understand what's going on in the background.
This computer science course is the last class of the day, but that can be a little tricky. The teacher says they've found some students so engaged that they have to ask them to leave, which is a good problem to have. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea and Quentin Chandler in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tom Bonsi from Portland, Oregon, Anna Rose MacArthur from Bethel, Angela Denning in Kodiak, and Josh Edge in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Sean Dugan.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career, and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided for all the training programs, providing students with housing, food, books, and tools. Learn more by calling 1-800-733-JOBS. This message sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.